It's all of these law firms. You're a law professor. The significance of this attack on law firms.
The attacks on law firms are one of the most dangerous things we're seeing. Look, one of the key checks that we have seen so far in the early days of the Trump administration on these authoritarian power grabs have been actions in court. Now, the president keeps flirting with the idea of not obeying court orders, but so far, the courts have been holding, and you need lawyers to bring those cases in court. So instead of attacking the courts directly, what he's doing is attacking the lawyers. He's trying to intimidate the entire legal profession into standing down and leaving him a free open path to do whatever it is that he wants. He understands that law can be a check on authoritarian moves. So he's trying to bankrupt these law firms. Now, every law firm that has gone to court so far has gotten a quick and strong order from a judge protecting them from these executive orders. That should be a strong signal to every other law firm out there. What the Trump administration is trying to do with these attacks is unconstitutional. You are lawyers. You can go to court and you can file for that type of protection. And I hope that each time a law firm does that, it will breed more and more courage across the profession, because that's another sector that needs to stand united and stand tall in the face of these threats.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and just add on Sussman Godfrey that they did represent Dominion Voting Systems. Andrew Manuel Crespo, Morris Wasserstein, Public Interest Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, General Counsel of the Harvard Faculty Chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which has filed a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of Trump funding cuts that sought a court order to block them. This is Democracy Now!
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to KBOO. I want to see you grow.
Michael Van Cleek here, Vice President of the KBOO Board of Directors. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. KBOO's nominating committee is holding virtual information sessions from now through June. All KBOO community members are eligible for board election. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are especially encouraged to apply. Come join us. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of our members. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. One word. Thank you for considering board service for KBOO Community Radio.
Show me your moves.
Be sure to tune into the Vinyl Pajama Party on Tuesday, April 22nd, for Everything's Earth, a very extra special Earth Day special. It's all about our planet, everything on it and in it. How will Brian do it? You, seriously, should not miss this presentation. And, as is the style, we'll have a rip-roaring good time. Just for you. And you. And yes, you too. That's Tuesday, April 22nd, at 3 a.m. Only on KBOO Portland. And available anytime after at kboo.fm.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge finds probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt for its deportation flights.
California sues the Trump administration for impacts tariffs are expected to have on its economy.
And in local news, Portland City Council will hear the anti-AI price-fixing ordinance tonight at 6 o'clock.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 16th, 2025. I'm Sherry Meredith.
And I'm Josh Salem. U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg just ruled that there is probable cause to hold Trump administration officials in criminal contempt for violating his previous orders halting the use of the Aliens Enemy Act to deport alleged Venezuelan gang members. The judge is still deciding punishment as well as the next steps he may take. He is also giving the Justice Department an opportunity to respond. The situation has already been a major legal flashpoint for Trump in his efforts to carry out a massive deportation campaign. The Alien Enemies Act is an 18th century law that has been invoked three times in U.S. history. It serves as justification for the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Trump said he was using it to target Venezuela's Tren de Aragua gang. Boasberg's district court ruled in March to block deportations under the act, but at least 250 alleged Tren de Aragua members were sent to El Salvador after the order. Boasberg said today in a 46-page ruling, quote, "The court ultimately determines that the government's actions on that day demonstrate a willful disregard for its order, sufficient for the court to conclude that probable cause exists to find the government in criminal contempt." He added, quote, "The court does not reach such conclusion lightly or hastily. Indeed, it has given defendants ample opportunity to rectify or explain their actions. None of their responses has been satisfactory." End quote.
President Trump signed an executive order entitled "Lowering Drug Prices by Once Again Putting Americans First" to delay Medicare negotiations for a broad category of prescription drugs. The order instructs Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to work with Congress to modify the Medicare drug price negotiation program that was established by President Biden. Prior to Biden's actions, Medicare, one of the country's largest purchasers of pharmaceuticals, was forbidden from negotiating prices. Trump wants to extend the time period that certain classes of drugs are exempt from price negotiations. The advocacy group Protect Our Care said following that, quote, "Trump just caved to Big Pharma again. His new executive order pushes to delay Medicare price negotiations, giving drug companies 4 extra years to price gouge seniors," end quote.
California filed a lawsuit today to block Trump's recent tariffs, accusing the president of overstepping his authority in causing what was labeled immediate and irreparable harm to the world's fifth largest economy. The lawsuit was filed by California's Governor Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Rob Bonta. The officials argue that the U.S. Constitution explicitly grants Congress the power to impose tariffs and that the president's invocation of emergency powers to act unilaterally is unlawful. Governor Newsom said, quote, "President Trump's unlawful tariffs are wreaking chaos on California families, businesses, and our economy, driving up prices and threatening jobs." He continued, quote, "We're standing up for American families who can't afford to let the chaos continue," end quote. As the U.S.'s largest importer and second largest exporter, California's top trading partners are Mexico, Canada, and China, all subjects of heavy tariffs. Newsom said his administration would pursue its own trade deals with international partners to exempt California from retaliatory tariffs.
Washington farm worker activist Alfredo Juarez Zafrino was imprisoned by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in late March. And activists have been protesting for his release ever since. KBOO's Anna Wilcox has more.
Processing center in Tacoma. Alfredo Lelo Juarez Zafarino has been imprisoned since March 25th when he was forcibly detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in Skagit County, Washington. Juarez Zafarino helped found Familias Unidas por la Justicia, an independent union to help farm workers in Washington state. According to Truthout, he advocated for overtime pay, heat protections, and against the exploitative nature of the H-2A guest worker program. ICE detained the 25-year-old while he was driving his partner to work. Truthout reports that Juarez Zafarino asked for a warrant, and ICE agent smashed his car window while Juarez Zafarino responded to a request to retrieve his ID. Agents took Juarez Zeferino to an unmarked warehouse after his arrest. Later, he was transferred to the Tacoma Processing Center. Local activists were aware that the unmarked warehouse was an ICE holding facility. They protested the warehouse for the first time several years ago. Juarez Zeferino is one of several prominent activists abducted by ICE since March, as the Trump administration increases actions against immigrants. Other arrests include the pro-Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil and Rumaisa Ozturk. Edgar Franks, the political director of Familias Unidas por la Justicia, met Juarez Zeferino when he was a teenager. Juarez Zeferino arrived in the U.S. when he was 13 years old. Franks told New Republic, quote, "We think this is a politically motivated detention. He was not hiding. He was in the media and in videos. He goes to lobby in our state capitol. If he thought he had a deportation order, he wouldn't have done that." End quote. Rosalinda Guillen, a farm worker and activist in Skagit County, told KUOW, quote, "He doesn't have a criminal record, and we think that they stopped him because of his leadership, because of his activism. We're trying to get him out." End quote. Juarez Zeferino had a standing deportation order from 2018. He was sent to the Tacoma Detention Center once before in 2015 after he was pulled over for driving on the wrong side of the road. Juarez Zeferino was 15 years old at the time. In 2015, the Bellingham Herald reported that Juarez Zeferino was an applicant for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. DACA allows children who came into the U.S. without legal status to receive temporary protection against deportation. Guillen told Seattle's The Stranger, quote, "We're worried they're going to deport him to El Salvador, Gitmo, or these other places that are horrific," end quote. In March, the Trump administration wrongly deported Salvadoran immigrant Kilmar Abrego Garcia to El Salvador. A judge granted Abrego Garcia protections against deportation in 2019. Abrego Garcia is currently being held in El Salvador's mega prison, a maximum security prison that uses severe force against gang members. El Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele told President Trump that he would not grant Abrego Garcia's return to the U.S. For KBOO, this is Anna Wilcox.
Portland City Council will hold its second reading of its anti-AI price-fixing ordinance tonight. The ordinance has attracted a lot of interest, so testimony is capped at 2 minutes per person. If passed, the ordinance would ban landlords and property owners from using artificial intelligence algorithms to set rental prices in the city. Price-fixing is already illegal, but this makes clear that using an outside service to fix rents is also not allowed. By typical logic, landlords want to rent an open property as soon as possible. But with a price-fixing algorithm, they could be convinced to keep the unit unfilled in hopes of finding a higher bidder. If every unit at building or neighborhood is doing this, the result is an artificially inflated rental market and artificial housing scarcity. Portland and Oregon, more broadly, have been in an ongoing state of emergency regarding lack of housing units. Realtors, developers, and the Portland Metro Chamber have come out against the ordinance, saying it would make people not want to develop new housing in Portland. They also worry that it would hurt small landlords. That point is unlikely based on the text of the ordinance. It specifically targets AI algorithms used to fix rents. Street Roots reporting revealed that at least one of these companies, RealPage, which is currently being sued for the practice, only allows owners with more than 30 properties to use their service. Portland City Council meets this evening at 6 p.m.
A popular state-funded matching program seeks more funding to help lower-income Oregonians get onto sound footing, financial footing. Individual development accounts have helped 19,000 people save for things like school or buying a home while providing financial literacy classes. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A state-funded match savings program has helped low-income Oregonians for over 25 years, but now backers say it needs more funding to continue. Participants in the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative save money towards specific goals like buying a home or vehicle or going to college while working with local nonprofits. Once they reach their savings goal, the state matches it at a 5-to-1 ratio, helping build long-term financial stability. Abby Brambila is a first-generation Oregon college graduate and small business owner who credits the IDA program. She says the financial support made college possible and its budgeting classes gave her confidence.
These skills are going to take you further than any amount of money. For me, it really has been life-changing, and I do believe that other people deserve to get into a program like this.
Despite rising costs for goals like education and home ownership, IDA program funding has remained flat for 15 years. Advocates are asking the legislature to update the funding to reflect inflation. Cameron Harrington is with Neighborhood Partnerships, which helps distribute IDA funds. He says lawmakers have two options to shore up the program's funding: raise the cap on its main tax credit or dedicate some lottery revenue. Harrington says IDA has helped over 19,000 low-income Oregonians since it started, but can't continue at its current pace without more support. He adds both bills have bipartisan backing statewide.
It's a matter of the budget writers at the legislature stepping up to the plate now and fixing the funding. It's overdue, but we've set it up for them to make an easy decision to keep this program strong for the future.
Both bills to increase funding are in committee. Backers of the IDA initiative say it helps bridge the growing income gap in the state as well as the racial wealth gap. Data show the top 1% of earners in the state have more income than the bottom 50% of Oregonians combined. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Undocumented immigrants must now register with the federal government. Mass deportation costs states like Connecticut millions in tax revenue. And a new executive memo reinforces current laws on Social Security benefits for what it terms illegal aliens. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And using this Registration Act, asking that immigrants register, we are repeating a grave national error. We will see massive violations of human rights.
Angelica Salas with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights is one of many condemning President Donald Trump's use of the Alien Registration Act. As of April 11th, all undocumented immigrants have to register with the federal government within 30 days. The order is being challenged in court, though a federal judge is allowing it to go forward. Salas says it's asking people to sign up for mass deportations. This comes as the administration seems to be defying federal courts when sending migrants they claim are gang members to prison in El Salvador. A 60 Minutes investigation found 3/4 of those deported don't have criminal records. This includes Kilmar Abrego Garcia of Maryland, sent to El Salvador's notorious terrorism confinement center by mistake. The Supreme Court ruled the administration has to facilitate bringing him home, but Trump and the president of El Salvador say they won't bring him back. The migrants are being sent to El Salvador under an 18th century wartime law, which courts have said does not apply. States could face economic and fiscal problems from mass deportations. A new report from the Immigration Research Initiative and Connecticut Voices for Children found Connecticut could lose more than $400 million in tax revenue. Author David Disregard Kallick says entire industries could grind to a halt.
It's not just for the people who are working in the jobs where people who are undocumented tend to be concentrated in the lowest of jobs, but you can't do the whole job unless you have those people there to do that. And so that would also mean job loss for the electrician, for the carpenters, for the architect, and for the construction companies.
Meanwhile, Trump has signed a presidential memo aimed at preventing illegal aliens from receiving Social Security. Migrants without legal status virtually never collect Social Security, despite contributing more than $25 billion to the system each year. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says the new order will prevent waste and corruption.
It will expand the Social Security Administration's fraud prosecutor program to at least 50 U.S. attorney offices and establishes a Medicare and Medicaid fraud prosecution program in 15 U.S. attorney offices.
This comes after the Trump administration falsely listed 6,000 living immigrants as dead, saying that will enable the canceling of their Social Security numbers and could push them to, quote, self-deport. Levitt says anyone who disagrees with the common sense policies of this administration can find a new job. Now that the U.S. House has passed the SAVE Act, civil rights groups say the effort to stop non-citizens from getting the ballot will stop legitimate voting. Lauren Groh-Wargo with Fair Fight Action says making people prove their citizenship could stop more than 20 million qualified Americans from voting.
There's other documents that you can provide, like your original birth certificate. Well, but if your birth certificate changed because your name is no longer what you were born under, if you are a married woman, for example, and took your husband's name, that's not going to cut it.
Current federal law already requires voters to attest their citizenship under penalty of perjury, and illegal non-citizen voting almost never happens. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth report interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about the Portland Ritz-Carlton developer evading the city's nearly $8 million affordable housing fee. Then we'll check in with Laura Grimes from Oregon Arts Watch for the latest in arts going on. At 6, it's Radio Zine. On this episode, a look at the group Indivisible. Is it a Democrat astroturf? At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio with Doug McVeigh. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a daytime high of 68. Today in history, in 2018, the New York Times and the New Yorker win the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for breaking news of the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse scandal. The quote of the day from French writer Anatole France, who said, quote, if 50 million people say a foolish thing, it's still a foolish thing.
The United Kingdom Supreme Court ruled today that a woman is someone born biologically female. This excludes transgender people from the legal definition. Five judges ruled unanimously that the UK Equality Act means trans women can be excluded from some group and single-sex spaces, such as changing rooms, houseless shelters, swimming areas, and medical or counseling services provided only to women. The ruling also means that a transgender person with a certificate that recognizes them as female should not be considered a woman for equality purposes. Transgender rights have recently been a contentious issue in many countries, and even more so in Republican-controlled states in the U.S. Many states have banned gender-affirming care for minors, excluded transgender women and girls from sports competitions that align with their gender, and restricted which public bathrooms transgender people can use. At the federal level, Donald Trump has signed orders to define the sexes as only male and female and has tried to remove trans service members from the military. His orders are being challenged in court. The UK case stems from a 2018 law passed by the Scottish Parliament saying 50% of the membership of the boards of Scottish public bodies should be women. Transgender women with gender recognition certificates were allowed in meeting the quota. Some argued the Scottish officials' redefinition of woman went beyond Parliament's powers, and the group For Women Scotland fought to overturn that. That case made its way to the Supreme Court. Their lawyer told the judges, three men and two women, that under the Equality Act, sex should refer to biological sex as understood, quote, in ordinary, everyday language. Trans rights advocates are condemning the judgment. The campaign group, Scottish Trans, said it was, quote, shocked and disappointed by the ruling, and that it would undermine legal protections for transgender people enshrined in the 2004 Gender Recognition Act. Other opponents, including Amnesty International, said excluding transgender people from sex discrimination protections conflicts with human rights laws. Amnesty said it's concerned about the deterioration of the rights for trans people in the UK and abroad. The group said, quote, a blanket policy of barring trans women from single-sex services is not a proportionate means to achieve a legitimate aim, end quote. Justice Patrick Hodge said the British ruling does not remove protection from trans people who are still protected from discrimination under UK law.
The U.S. House recently passed a bill that would require people to show proof of citizenship when they register to vote and force them to vote in person. That could make it a lot more difficult for Native American voters and other voting groups to cast their ballots. With this story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The House recently passed legislation to require people to prove they are U.S. citizens when they register to vote. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports, Native groups argue if the proposal becomes law, it would make it harder for Native people to vote.
The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, would also require people to register to vote in person. That means they could no longer register through the mail or online. That would make it difficult for many tribal members who live on reservations that are far from cities and highways, says Jacqueline De Leon. She's an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund.
The nearest election offices for many rural Native Americans can be over 100 miles round trip.
Voters would also have to show proof of U.S. citizenship, like a passport or birth certificate. De Leon says the bill claims that tribal members could use their tribal IDs.
But tribal IDs would have to have a place of location of birth on them to qualify, and most, if not all, tribal IDs don't have that on them.
But the SAVE Act does face long odds in the Senate, where 7 Democrats would have to join Republicans to allow it to proceed to a vote. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Voter turnout from tribal communities in Wisconsin has increased in recent years, with historic numbers for the recent state Supreme Court election. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The Menominee Reservation turnout increased by more than 80% from the spring 2023 election. Both the Red Cliff and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa saw turnout jump more than 60%, according to Wisconsin Conservation Voices. The group works with tribal communities through its Wisconsin Native Vote Program. Organizer Maria Haskins says listening sessions, roundtables, and regional dinners have been crucial in building relationships and getting people to the polls.
With people seeing their peers being more active in the polls and becoming more informed about a lot of these issues is what is really motivating them to go out and cast their ballot, because I think that people are realizing their vote is their voice.
Haskins says communities shared concerns at these events about issues like the opioid epidemic, which is severely affecting tribal communities, while drawing the connections of voting to their goal of tribal sovereignty. The Menominee community has seen some of the most dramatic jumps in voter turnout. In 2023, community voting increased by 75% and has seen a 220% increase since 2019. Haskins says she believes the influx reflects the increased tribes are also seeing in representation, with more Native Americans running for office.
I think that it's a huge movement. It's just something saying our people deserve to have a voice in what is happening, and we deserve to have the ability to be involved.
I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
A bill to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October passed the Nevada Assembly floor Tuesday with a vote of 27-15. Executive Director of the Native Voters Alliance Nevada, Taylor Patterson, called its passage a victory. In a statement, Patterson said, with its passage, the Assembly affirms the contributions, stories, and resilience of Indigenous peoples are vital to the identity of the state, and thanked the bill's sponsor, Shea Backus, the only Indigenous legislator in Nevada, for carrying the bill forward, and now advances to the Senate. The Chicago American Indian Community Collaborative, a coalition of nearly 20 Native-serving organizations, is celebrating the recent passage of a bill in the Illinois House that prohibits schools from using a Native name, mascot, or logo. The collaborative says the legislation represents a significant step in addressing the needs of Native communities across the state and encourages a shift from stereotypes to respect and cultural awareness. The bill is now in the Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Utilities are gradually shifting away from coal as an energy source, but the Trump administration still sees it as a viable resource. New findings throw cold water on the push to reinvest in coal. Experts say it isn't as simple as flipping an on switch at retired coal plants. Mike Moen has more in Minnesota.
Minnesota is cited in a new research brief that outlines the obstacles America would face in trying to reopen coal plants, an idea prioritized by the Trump administration. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that aims to boost coal production, despite coal's shrinking presence in the energy sector. The administration says the move can help meet growing electricity demand with the emergence of data centers. But the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis predicts giving coal-fired power plants new life would be costly. The Institute's Dennis Wamsted says it doesn't make sense.
It's not an evil conspiracy to push coal out of the market. The reality is that coal is the most expensive resource, and so it is rightfully used the least or used last.
He points to Xcel Energy's Sherco facility near the Twin Cities, a coal plant being phased out and replaced with a massive solar operation. Wamsted says utilities are planning for other sources because they're proven to be reliable and less costly. The analysis says 24 of the 102 recently closed U.S. coal plants are already torn down, and restarting others would require big investments due to their age. Wamsted says time is another problem because of the maintenance backlog in getting coal plants back online or in some cases rebuilt. He says investors wouldn't be interested in wanting to get an older plant reopened only to shut it down again because of the declining appetite for coal.
In 20 years or 30 years, that plant, which would still be relatively new, would probably be what we call a stranded asset.
And like clean energy infrastructure, Wamsted says ratepayers would be asked by utilities to cover the construction costs for increase in coal production. The difference, he says, is that sources like wind and solar are poised to stick around much longer, and they don't have the price volatility linked with fossil fuels. This is Mike Bowen for Minnesota News Connection.
The drafters of the original Clean Air Act saw CO2 as a pollutant. Climate change and carbon dioxide came up regularly in 60s-era congressional hearings, according to a team of Harvard historians. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. More than 50 years ago, Republican President Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act of 1970. It authorizes the federal government to regulate harmful air pollutants. And it was well understood at the time that one of those pollutants was climate-warming carbon dioxide. Naomi Oreskes, a professor of the history of science at Harvard University, says many people now are unaware of this history.
There have been debates both in Congress and in the courts about whether or not the Clean Air Act applies to carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases.
So her team reviewed government documents from the 1960s. She said they found more than 100 congressional hearings in which CO2 and human-caused climate change were discussed.
And what we were able to show was that the members of Congress who wrote and passed the Clean Air Act were well aware of carbon dioxide, and they understood that it was a pollutant.
She says that's why the words weather and climate are included in the text of the law.
And so if anyone tries to claim, oh, there's no way Congress could have intended this statute to apply to carbon dioxide, it's just wrong, and we've now shown that it's wrong.
And she says knowing what lawmakers intended back then is important when determining how the law should be applied now. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climate.